Hello and welcome to Talking Scared. I'm your host, Neil McRobert, and this week we combine my joys and my terrors. Running and losing my mind. Some people may argue that the former is a sure sign of the latter, no doubt. Anyway, we're joined by Tim Leben, a proper distance runner and the writer of the highest quality adventure horror this bleak island has to offer. Tim's written over 40 novels, but his last three, Eden, The Last Storm, and this new one, Among the Living, are a loose thematic trilogy of what happens when we mess around with nature. Hint, it messes with us. Tim and I talk about eco-horror in all its forms. We consider how writing action relates to writing character. We discuss the biological threats facing mankind. And of course, we talk about running too. And we do get quite into it, because it's rare I get the chance, but we also keep it relevant to writing as best we can. If you love the horror chat, not necessarily the running chat, but if you love the horror stuff, consider subscribing to Patreon at patreon.com/talkingscaredpod. You get tons of bonus episodes, including a whole special recent episode with Tim and Ali Wilkes talking all about their favourite adventure horror, and loads more. It really helps me keep making this show. So again, patreon.com/talkingscaredpod, or click the link in the show notes. And thank you. Now, come with me to a frozen bit of land out on the Earth's extremity. We can go for a long, long run together, but the thing we're running from may already be inside us. Let's talk scared. Hiya, Tim, and welcome to Talking Scared. How are you, mate?
I'm good, Neil. Thanks so much for having me. Great to be here.
Oh, it's a delight to have you. Always fun to have a fellow Brit on the show to do my bit for homegrown horror, which I unintentionally neglect every year. Every year I say I'm going to get more Brits on, and then for some reason I don't. The Americans just invade like it's the late 40s.
Yeah, there's a lot more of them.
Yeah, there are. Yeah, they come mob-handed with a massive marketing budget that I don't get any of.
Right,
but
yeah.
Anyway, shouldn't whinge. I've been meaning to have you on the show for a good while now, because we seem to have circled each other for years now, really.
Yeah, we have, and often talking about running more than horror, but I mean, you know, we've been like online friends for a long time, and it's just it just never came to pass, did it? But
no.
I think, you know, it's a good book for it to happen for, so it's great to be here.
We both like running silly distances, and sorry, listeners, that will probably come up once or twice in the next hour, though it will be somewhat textually relevant, I'll say that. But what you won't know, Tim, is that you wrote the first reader review copy of a book that I ever received. So years before this podcast, Titan kindly sent me a copy of your, shall we say, eco-adventure novel, Eden.
Right.
And now here we are in a nice tidy bow discussing a book that is at least tangentially linked to Eden.
Fantastic, yeah.
And it's your newest novel, Among the Living, which I have horrified thoughts about. I really do. This book did a number on me.
I'm sorry to say I'm glad, but I guess that's sometimes a reaction a horror writer's after, you know? Yeah, good.
Well, can you introduce us to Among the Living, please?
Yeah, sure. Yeah, so it's so Eden was, I guess, the first of my climate eco-horror thrillers. The Last Storm was the second, and Among the Living is the third. As you say, it's very tangentially connected. They're not really a trilogy. There's a few Easter eggs. There's this idea that they're set on the same version of Earth around the same time. But other than that, the only real link between the three books is that climate change and environmental disaster is part of the story. So in Among the Living, it's the melting permafrost in the Arctic Circle that releases, that is potentially, you know, there are horrifying news items about this, that potentially releasing viruses that have been dormant for many, many thousands of years. And in Among the Living, I've got sort of two groups of people. And the one group is prospecting for rare earth minerals. And if they find something, they'll sell the information to massive corporations that will come in and mine the place. And then the other group are environmental activists who are trying to stop this from happening. And the two leaders of each group, one is called Dean, he's in the prospectors, and Bethan is leading the environmental group. They're sort of estranged friends, not lovers, but friends. So there's this real tense relationship between them. And when they sort of converge on this newly revealed cave revealed by the melting permafrost, they find something down there that starts infecting them, and stuff happens, obviously, following on from that. And the two groups, it's about the two groups having to sort of come together to try and survive, to try and stop this ancient zombie. I shouldn't have used the word zombie. It's not a zombie book. They call them zombie viruses because they've been asleep for so long. But this ancient virus from infecting them all and potentially spreading around the world. And that's sort of the setup of the book, really.
Yeah, and right off the back, I'm just going to say, this book gave me a genuine anxiety attack.
Oh, God, sorry. That's awful.
Don't apologise, because usually that's a bad thing. But on this show, it's just an added marketing boost for your book. It genuinely did, though, right? It ruined my day. And we'll get to that particular upsetting detail in due course. But I am glad I've had a bit of time between finishing the book and recording this. Otherwise, this would just be an hour of me demanding reassurance from you that none of this is real.
Well, none of it's made up. But the fact is, there are probably ancient viruses buried away that may, you know, emerge. And that's been happening, you know, the whole Ebola and stuff like that. That's come out of landscapes being opened up and better communications and, you know, building roads and this world becoming smaller, essentially. So it's probable there are viruses and diseases buried away from tens of thousands of years ago. Doesn't mean to say that it's going to have the effect it has in my book, obviously.
We do hope, yeah. As I say, I'll get to why it upset me so much, but it's a very particular thing with me, which we'll get to. But it's funny you say that about Ebola, because it's reminded me of something. I read a really fascinating article years ago, and it talked about a list. I think it was like 10 things that you didn't know changed the face of humanity or could change the world. It was sort of looking at, you know, forget the fall of the Berlin Wall. It's like other things that, you know, we perhaps didn't realize. And one of the ones that it said was a completely like species changing event was the building of the Kinshasa Highway in Africa, which because it for the first time allowed Ebola to escape from these isolated communities. Yeah. And it always chilled me that.
Yeah, it's a terrifying thought. You know, for all of history, these diseases have been confined to certain parts of the world. I think the thought is Ebola was probably existed in one valley you know, one ravine in Africa somewhere, and accessing this place, maybe exploring it or exploring it to monopolize its, you know, wealth of minerals and things like that. Possibly that opened it up. But yeah, that's a fascinating fact, actually, and pretty terrifying as well. And it's why the pandemic spread so quickly, that Earth is a really small place. You know, a couple of hundred years ago, COVID would have spread much more slowly. But now there are planes, and that's just it. You know, day one, it's around the world.
Well, are there specific things that you read that played into this? Because there's a lot of sort of modern speculation, but there's also a kind of a sort of historical narrative of, you know, exotic and rogue diseases back through human history. So are there things that you read that you kind of thought, oh, that's going in the book, or that's informing the book?
All the historical stuff in there is made up. There weren't those outbreaks on the Pacific Islands that Goyo, one of my main characters, talks about. That's made up. And also, I tried to make a point that this wasn't the opiocordyceps disease, you know, the zombie ant disease that is used that they use in The Last of Us and that sort of thing. It's a similar type of infection. But I love the idea of an intelligent virus, you know, because when people talk about viruses and bacteria, they talk about them as if they're intelligent, but they're not. You know, this virus wants to transfer to you. It's not sitting there thinking, right, I've got this guy, now I'm going to get this woman over here, I'm going to infect her. They're not intelligent, but people talk about them that way. But I just thought it's pretty terrifying to actually create some sort of infection that is actually endemically intelligent and will wait for thousands of years until it senses the you know, the proximity of people who it hasn't infected, and that's when it blooms and fungates and starts to infect. I read a book called, I think it was called Entangled. I may have it here. And it's about how fungi basically control the world. It sounds ridiculous and terrifying, but you know, you and I are outdoor lovers. You walk into a woodland and there's a whole network of fungi beneath your feet that connects trees. And again, this book sort of makes it sound as if it's intelligent. Trees communicate with each other. But they really do. There's a form of chemical communication running through woodlands, carried an electrical communication carried by this fungal network, mycelium network. I found that really, really fascinating. So I read quite a bit of background stuff like that. And then you combine that with the idea of the melting permafrost, and the sort of exciting stuff about that is mammoth bodies being brought to the surface and but then the effects on communities as well and environment. Oh, I can't remember the name. There's a place in northern Siberia where a massive, like miles wide area of land has just started to sink. And it looks like a massive meteor crater, but it's actually where permafrost has melted, and it's this huge area of land is just dropped down like 100 meters. It's like a opposite version of a plateau, you know. It's an amazing place. Pretty scary. That starts happening across the globe, and what, you know, what's going to be revealed. So I did do a fair bit of sort of background reading, but like I said, everything, the history, the histories of diseases around the world, I made all that up, but I tried to make it sound as sort of believable as I could, really.
Well, it is backed up by, well, I'm loath to say science because I'm not intelligent or informed enough to know where the line between science and pseudoscience lies with this kind of stuff. You know what I mean? So, but it's certainly backed up by theorizing, because I did a bit of sort of cursory research. And from what I read, the oldest bacteria that they've managed to revive was in the Siberian tundra, and that's 49,000 years old. Which, if you think about it, preempts any possible human medical intervention, you know? And this same team, they said, where I say, I don't know if this shades into pseudoscience, I simply don't know, but that same team estimates that viruses could stay what they term active for up to 200,000 years, which predates most of what we think of as humanity and our basic immune system. So they may as well be extraterrestrial.
Yeah.
You know, if we're suddenly on Earth, then they may as well come from space.
Yeah. Yeah. They're viruses we don't know anything about. Like, whereas we knew what COVID was, we knew what type of virus it was. There could be, you know, stuff out there that what the hell is this? And I guess that's what I was trying to create in Among the Living. I mean, I'll be very honest. I wanted it to be a good horror romp. I think it is, you know, but I wanted it to be, I wanted to try and be original enough in the sort of the root concept that it grabbed people's attention.
Does it frighten you, Tim, the thought of these things out there melting, unearthing? Did it keep you up at night?
It doesn't keep me up at night. It does trouble me, but then there's a lot of stuff going on in the world today that troubles me, and I'm doing my best to not get overly troubled by everything. And there's good stuff going on in the world, and so while I try not to dwell on it. You know, I did research it and I read, people kept sending, when I was talking about the book, and certainly since it's been out, people have been sending me links to new articles. I read something today, it might have been similar to what you read, about a 40,000 year old virus they found buried somewhere in the permafrost in Alaska, I think, or northern Canada. And it's just, you know, but this sensationalism is clickbait, isn't it? It's this virus might wipe out the world.
Yeah.
And there's probably thousands of them coming out every year, being revealed and dying out or infecting, you know, and a lot of them wouldn't be able to infect us because, you know, lots of diseases don't jump between species. So it might be bad news for wolves one day, maybe. I don't know, but maybe not for us. So I don't dwell on it too much.
What troubles me is that you say that, like, it might not infect us, but we still have no real mapped understanding of broader ecosystems. So if something comes along and kills some kind of mite, you know, or some kind of fungus, I don't know, or you know, come on, kills a certain kind of beetle, we simply don't have the power yet, even with AI, to map the global ecosystem. So there's no saying that something that can't even infect us can't, you know, see us off just in, through a weird indirect cause and effect where we all starve to death because something's not germinating plants or whatever. You know, that's what haunts me.
Yeah, you know, bees. Mm. If bees are wiped out, you know, there's lots of species of bees, hundreds, I think, or maybe even thousands. But and there are bee bacteria, I believe. But if the bees are wiped out, then what pollinates the plants and you know, how do we grow food? And yeah, there's that horrible domino effect that you think about. And I said to my kids a couple of times when they were growing up, you know, you find a bumblebee in the garden and they're running around scared. Kill it, Dad. And I don't, you know, I don't kill anything if I can avoid it. I don't kill wasps or anything. And I'd say, no, you got to, you know, and if I say you've got to save this bee, and if you save this bee, you might actually save the world. This might be the balancing point. If this bee dies, that might just tip everything over the balance. And they're, what you want about, Dad? I said, forget about it. I'm just thinking, talking crap. But yeah, it's stuff like that is a little scary. But you can search for stuff to terrify yourself. And at the moment, you don't have to search too far. Things like this for, you know, researching stuff like this for the book and writing about it. Like I said, I wanted to write just not a fun horror book. I don't think you can, Among the Living isn't really fun, but it's more, you know, I've been saying to people, it's more of a horror novel than I've written in quite a few years, really, I think. And that was a conscious thing. I wanted to get back to my sort of my roots, I suppose. It's my 48th published novel. And, you know, I'm known as a horror writer generally more than anything, really. And I thought to myself, I'm going to write this as a horror novel. So the idea totally lends itself to it more than the other two novels, I think.
And it is a fun horror novel, and I know what you mean by that. And it's a word I tussle with often on this show because, well, I repeat this like ad nauseum that fun isn't a dirty word. You know, I think these days fun is seen to mean something superficial. I've said all this before. I'm not going to reiterate it, but I think fun is a cherished term because if it's something's not fun, why are we bothering? Right.
Right. Yeah.
This is what most people would call, I think, a fun horror novel. It's fast-paced, it's propulsive, it's action-packed.
Yeah.
It makes you squirm and worry. And, you know, I mean, it wasn't fun for me because it tweaked some very particular parts of my brain. But for most people, you've nailed it. This is the way, you know, they used to write them, as they always say.
Yeah. Well, I guess the way I used to write them. You know, I try the propulsiveness. I try that in all my books. The last three novels I've written have all been, I think Eden, The Last Storm and this were all probably beneath or below 80,000 words. I think Among the Living is like 70,000. It's a short novel, you know. And I always try and get pace in there, and I'm very careful about my pacing. Some of my, you know, some people have said this one started slow and Eden started slow, but I there's got to be a little bit of a build in there. So I'm always conscious of pacing, but this one especially, I wanted it to be, like you say, it's propulsive and pretty action-packed while still having interesting ideas behind it, you know. For me, I try and make the characters the most affecting part of the book in as much as they drive the action, and they're also the most compulsive for the reader, you know.
Well, that's a really interesting point, because I haven't read a great deal of your books, but the ones I have read have been very fast-paced, and I don't just mean that in terms of plot events. I mean your characters are often moving physically at pace.
Absolutely.
Is that first question, is that just a natural storytelling mold for you to have action as the movement as the driving force?
It's certainly become that way, and I'm good friends with Sarah Pinborough, and we've known each other since we both started writing, really. And she said to me one day, I think, I can't remember which book she was reading. It might have been The Hunt, which is the thriller I wrote, which you'd love because it's basically Iron Man getting shot at. So we can talk about that a little bit. And she said, everything you write, it's people being chased or people chasing. And I thought, shit, it is. I haven't really tweaked that, but it is. And I think for me, so something I've not written, and somebody asked me on another interview recently, what would you like to write? And I think I'd really like to write a haunted house story, but that feels quite static. And I guess it's something in my muse says to move the story, you've got to move the story and have movement. So, and that's just the way my stories tend to plan out. Also, I love the outside. I love the outdoors. Eden, The Last Storm to an extent, and this one certainly take place in extreme environments, which interests me as well. So, it's something that's definitely happened over the last probably 5 or 6 books without me consciously making a decision to make it happen. And that's just, I think it's natural when you, like I said, I've written quite a few books. It's natural that you sort of steer this way and that way through your writing career. And I'm quite happy with it. But, I've actually sold another novel that's coming out in a couple of years, and it's a chase novel. Thinking about it, yeah. So I don't analyze stuff like this too much, to be honest, Neil. I like the idea that, my muse is driving me. That sounds a bit wanky, but I go with the story when the story comes up, and it sort of says to itself, it says to me, this would be good if the character starts here and finishes there, and somebody's following them or they're following somebody. I run with it and let it happen.
This is why I love interviews with fellow Brits, because we get halfway through a question or an answer, just go, oh, that's far too wanky. I can't say that's too pompous. Well, I mean, you might not like the next question then, because this is pure craft question. But if we're going to agree that your last few books have been all about movement, all about propulsion, how do you work character within that? Because for a lot of people, sort of a propulsive plot and character would seem to be two different things. I think you managed to balance the two. So how do you do that? How do you inject character into a book which is so much about physical action?
Interesting question. I think because this book especially, lots happens in a short period of time, then the characters are encountering change really quickly, and therefore they're having to change very quickly with it. And that's good in one way, because it enables you to, they say your character's got to be different at the end of a book from what they were at the beginning, and it enables you to do that quite easily because shit's happened, and they've had to face stuff or face people or chase or escape, that sort of thing. But also what I really like about this book in particular is my two main characters, Dean and Bethan, and I love the relationship between them because they're estranged friends. I wanted to get away from the idea that they used to be lovers and they fell out. They used to be really good friends. So they were environmental activists, and Bethan just went a bit more extreme than Dean. And she caused an accident at a fracking site where 3 people were killed. And she was like, well, they had it coming. And Dean was, what? You've actually, you've killed people. Accidentally, yes, but it's happened. And Bethan's like, well, it's, and in a way, it's sort of talking about some of the extremes people are going to nowadays for, environmental activism, I guess. I don't think it's got to that stage yet, but who knows? So I really liked the character setup. And I guess I start when they're estranged. So the whole book's about them trying to come back together and put their differences aside to face the danger that they've essentially caused themselves. I don't see the fact that it's a fast moving book, both in plot and, location. I don't see that as a problem with character. Sometimes it makes it a bit more difficult, the characters sitting down to have a chat when there's things chasing them or stuff like that. So I guess I've got to be careful that they're not running constantly across the landscape, a really violent, inhospitable landscape, being chased by these creatures that they don't know anything about. And then, so how are you? So what have you been doing over the last couple of years? That can't happen. I think it works out okay. And there's the Something else I sometimes get a bit mixed up with. I'm writing a space horror novel at the moment, and I'm just on spec, and I'm really enjoying it, and it's a lot of fun, but there's lots of characters, and so sometimes I'm thinking, oh, do I need to open an airlock or something, get rid of a few of them, because you know, if you've got eight characters on a bridge in a spaceship and they're discussing something, it just gets a bit confusing, and to make them all a bit diverse and different and interesting can get quite cumbersome. So sometimes you think, oh, this character's not really doing much, let's give them a fun exit.
Yeah, I suppose in this kind of story as well, if you have a character who's not doing much, you just go like, right, okay, just kill them. That's their purpose in this story, right? You always need some victims. So you don't have to go back and, you know, unpick and unweave them from the narrative. You just kill them.
Yeah, I remember I used to read a lot of James Herbert when I was a teen, and I met him once, actually. It was one of the few times I've met a writer and been a bit starstruck, because I read The Rats when I was...
Yeah.
I think my mum gave me The Rats to read when I was 10. It was my first adult book. I mean, it was really adult, you know. Thanks, mum. Yeah. Didn't do me any harm. So James Herbert always used to... Something I noticed in his books, even back then when I was a kid, and it's something... Some writers really don't do. He'll introduce a character and give you a full background, give you 10 pages or 8 pages about this character and what he likes and where he's from. And then he'll get eaten by rats. And then he's got no part of the novel at all. He's just the incidental character that he's decided he's going to tell you all about. And what's the point? You don't need to know where this character went to school and where their first date with their wife was, and you know what their favorite color is, only for them to turn a corner and be destroyed or eaten by rats. It seems a bit strange to me. So, but I do want my characters to feel, you know, even the ones that don't have a long future, I want them to feel real, not necessarily so that the readers will empathize, because they won't know them very well early stage, but just so that their relationship to other characters feels real when they meet and ask the end. You know, there's a scene at the beginning of the book where somebody dies, and I really wanted to get across the effect that death had on everyone, all the characters, because it was a really impactful scene, and it was really important that kicks off the book, really. Mm. You know, I do use flashback. Some people say it's a lazy way, but sometimes I don't think it is. I think flashback's a good way of building stories. And the campfire scene in this book that I'm thinking of is really, really vital to the story, actually.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Because it's when Goyo is talking about the stuff they've encountered. And it's sort of a pivotal part of the book. So Goyo is this older character in the book. He's been around and he's seen stuff. And he's asking his friends, what scares you? And they say, oh, you know, spiders and being buried or whatever. And he says, intelligent disease. And it sort of enables me, maybe it's lazy. I don't think it is. I think it works okay. It enables me as the writer to sort of set out what it is they've encountered. Not in a textbook way, not in Goyo saying, right, here's a chapter on intelligent diseases. But him saying, what scares me is something coming out of, you know, something, environmental change, releasing something that it has had its time and it shouldn't be released anymore. It's happened 100, like you were saying, the viruses from 100,000 years ago, they should be dead and gone, because naturally they're buried in the permafrost. Unnaturally, they're being revealed by human action. I totally went off at a tangent then. I think I was still talking about the character thing and the propulsiveness. I don't think it's a barrier against developing good characters. In fact, it's through reaction is how you learn about the characters more.
Yeah, but you said about that campfire scene, how pivotal it is. And the thing I like possibly most about this book, actually, is this way that you trace, I don't know, the sort of vague contours of this threat back through history. And all of that comes to a head in these scenes where Goyo is talking about the things he's seen. I love that. I love any kind of fictitious history. I love when people sit back and go, okay, let's join some invisible dots here.
Yeah.
It is a weird comparison. In a way, what you do in this book is not dissimilar to what Lovecraft did in The Call of Cthulhu. Whereas like Lovecraft was mapping pockets of worship of this deity all around the world and across history. You're mapping appearances of this, or maybe cousins of this disease, through history and across the planet.
Yeah.
And I always imagine it must be a lot of fun creating those grand fake histories.
Yeah, it's a huge amount of fun. And I, having the background that you mentioned, the coming up with the fake histories and the threads of story through time, makes it feel more three-dimensional and more real. You know, people might read this book thinking, oh, I'll research that story that Goyo says around the campfire.
Well, I did.
Oh, you're right. Okay. I mean, there are similar ideas, but I did some research for this. But I've had Ali Wilkes and I discuss research quite a bit last time we met up in London, and about how if you're writing a certain type of book, Ali writes historical horror novels set in real, you know, real periods and. So she researches stuff quite heavily, and it's really important not to put all your research in the book. Some writers do, and their books are 800 pages long, and this person's obviously spent a lot of time researching the type of footwear worn by sailors in 1824, because all the characters are talking about their friggin' footwear.
We mean Dan Simmons.
thank you. Yes, that's exactly the person Ali and I were talking about. Yeah, you're right. I'm a big fan of much of his stuff, but yes, lots of the research ended up in the books. Yeah. same thing with these made-up histories. I could have gone much more in-depth, I think. And I like... So when Goyo tells these stories, they feel to me like dark fairy tales.
Mm.
Because they really are. He's recounting stories he's heard. He's not recounting known fact. He's recounting stuff he's heard, you know, from whispers down... campfire whispers, essentially. And I think it really interests me, making a story feel more three-dimensional, you know, having a history and a background to the story, even if it's made up and fake, which of course it is because it's a story.
Well, what it made me think about, and this is just, sorry, every now and again I do this where I just basically inject something I'm interested in into a conversation, I sort of crowbar something in.
Okay.
Well, yeah. I think you'll like this, because I may have mentioned this before on the pod, I don't know, but you know, there's when one of your two teams at the start goes into this cave that basically catalyzes this story.
Yeah,
they find these wall paintings in this cave that, you know, they shouldn't exist. They should predate any known history. You know, they predate the kind of Lascaux. Is it Lascaux? The caves in France. I don't know how you pronounce it, but. That famous horse.
Yeah.
Anyway,
Let's
go. Something like that. Anyway, they predate all of that, and I have this fascination. What is it? And it's basically, sorry, these paintings are basically warnings of what this threat is.
Yeah.
And I have long been fascinated by story as a tool of warning, because have you ever heard of the Atomic Brotherhood?
Don't think so.
Right. This is. It's one of my favourite facts. I bring it up in any given opportunity. The Atomic Brotherhood is a think tank. I don't know if it still exists, but it did. And it was a think tank that came together in the wake of the birth of sort of nuclear power, nuclear fission, and the creation of nuclear waste. And they came up with the question, first of all, of the threat of radiation exceeds a human lifespan by such a degree that we need warning systems that can span, you know, traditions, that can span cultures, that can exceed any number of generations. Because just right, making a sign's not going to work. And if anyone wants a real, like, really interesting thought experiment, go away and have a look at the Atomic Brotherhood, because they came up with some insane theories. Because first of all, people said about, you know, come up with a sign that shows in pictographic form where someone walks into a space, touches something that looks like radiation or whatever, and then dies. And that prompted the question, yeah, but that presumes that we all read from left to right. Because if you read from right to left,
right.
That's something bringing people back to life. You know what I mean? Someone came up with the idea of literally breeding a cat that would turn red if it went near radiation. That was a genuine theory, that you breed a cat that would react...
Right.
Chromatically to radiation. But then people are saying, like, yeah, what if the nature of red changes, no longer a threat? The only solution that anyone came up with, and this is why your story made me think of it, the only solution was to create a mythology that was so fertile and so sort of, I don't know, so profound that it would sort of penetrate human culture, so that even in millennia, when we have forgotten the root of the myth, we will still abide by it.
Right. That's amazing.
I find it the most fascinating thing, because I love story. I'm sure you do. And to think about story being the only thing that could potentially save us.
Yeah.
And when you had that cave painting that was trying to do exactly that, I was like, oh, that is brilliant. It's so eerie, that thing being passed down through the millennia.
Yeah. And yeah, you wonder what they, you know, the people who did the cave paintings were thinking of, but they were sort of, you know, didn't have that much time to think about it. So they just, yeah, drew some weird, don't want to give too much away in the novel, mm-hmm. but there are entities, creatures at the end of the novel that I didn't intend introducing until I got there. I thought, oh, this will be interesting. Mm-hmm. I'll try this. And it seemed to work really well. And it seemed to really give those histories even more of an impact and make them deeper, make them feel as if they were not 40,000 years old, but my God, this could be, you know, this could be 400,000 years old before, like you said, before people as we know them existed now. What were these things? That sort of gave it a little bit of a, I don't want to say cosmic element, because that sounds Lovecraftian and it really isn't. Just more of a dark fairy tale feel, again, to use that term again. Also made me think about the idea that there are so many stories, fairy tales, histories, mythologies that we will never know anymore because they've come and gone. Wouldn't it be amazing to go back 15,000 years and understand the mythologies of people who existed then, people who lived then? It'd be incredible. So many are lost. And it's and I guess thinking around it now, it was never intentional, but this is finding one of those stories because of environmental change.
Yeah, stuff about that just floats my boat massively. The idea of deep time and...
Yeah, it fascinates me, yeah.
Let me tell you about why this book screwed me up so much for like 20
years. I was about to ask.
Okay. It's basically, it is this... this notion of an intelligent infection.
Right.
So I suppose, the base principle of this story, you know, is not dissimilar from, you know, John Carpenter's The Thing, another Arctic bio-horror story, you know. And, you know, in Carpenter's The Thing, the thing that infects people is a, you know, alien... whatever, it's a thing, right? Whereas in your story, it's a virus, stroke, fungus, stroke, this thing. But in both cases, they actively overwhelm the host. But you give that little nightmare an extra little twist of the spanner, because it controls our thoughts, but to the extent that it can make us think, it's not controlling my thoughts, I'm not infected. So it becomes this kind of inescapable prison of the mind. Where did you land on that awful idea? Because I get intelligent virus, but you came up with such a nightmarish puzzle box of how this thing would destroy our confidence in ourselves. How did you land on that?
Well, the whole paranoia of the thing is it's definitely, I mean, anyone listening to this, most people listening, is going to be towards the top of their list of favorite horror films, I'm sure. Certainly for me, it's probably in my top five horror films, I guess. And it's the utter paranoia of that. You know, it's a very different story, because like we said, mine is on the move all the time. But, and the thing is all contained within the, you know, the research station virtually. But the paranoia is still there. The scenes in The Thing that interest me most are when they're trying to figure out who's infected and who isn't. And the ones who are infected don't give anything away. So they know, I guess they know they're infected, but they're just, no, I'm fine, honestly. you know, even the final scene is, you know, you can translate that scene between MacReady and Childs, isn't it, in any way you want. And there's various theories. I took it as a bit of a challenge writing from the point of view of somebody who'd been infected. And that desire to do that steered the way, really, of how the disease worked. Mm. So it, you know, like you said, it infects you. You don't necessarily know. And maybe you get to know when the time comes for you to start spreading the disease that you've got within yourself, you know? I just found it an interesting writing challenge and a sort of a pretty scary philosophical question.
God, have you ever read Sarah Grand's Come Closer?
No, I haven't.
So it's a book that, I mean, I've mentioned this many times, it's a book I couldn't finish. I was too scared by it, because it's about a woman who may or may not be demonically possessed, but the possession manifests initially as a kind of weird hyper observancy of sound and intrusive thoughts, both of which I have this sound thing where if there's a weird noise, I have to know what it is, and I have intrusive thoughts. I'm basically a shuffling nervous wreck. It's a wonder I'm standing, Tim, you know.
Right, okay, yeah.
This book, I was literally reading it and loving it and not wanting to put it down, but at a sort of gut level, I was dreading any more chapters told from the perspective of people who were infected. Genuine dread in my stomach. This is all good stuff to hear for horror fans. So don't worry, Tim. This is the height of compliment.
It is.
I'm sure.
I don't like upsetting people, but thanks.
Yeah. Yeah. And the reason being is that I went to therapy a while back. God, how un-British have we been?
Oh, I've done it.
We don't talk about it. Right, and I was telling the therapist about how when I get really twitchy, I go into this thing where I'm constantly analysing my own thoughts and being like, why did I think that? What does it mean that I thought that? Oh, and I start having, and that then makes me stressed. And I start having more thoughts at a faster pace, which I can then understand less because I'm having them faster and I've got too many of them. And my mum calls it having a head full of broken biscuits, which is the best metaphor I've ever heard, right?
Ah, that's a good term. That's excellent, yeah.
But the therapist called it, it's an actual thing, it's called metacognition, when you become obsessively focused on your own thoughts. So imagine having that condition and then reading your book.
Yeah, I can see why it disturbed you that much, actually, because, like I said, those chapters, it's all about identity and really not knowing if you are who you were.
Yeah.
You know, we all, and it's an interesting thing, none of us are who we were yesterday, really, when you think about it. You know, we're all on this propulsive journey, just like my characters in my book, in one direction. And we all change. But not knowing if you're as in control as you were yesterday is pretty terrifying. You know, yeah, it's a scary thought, and you made me think about it more and more, actually. I just sat and wrote it, but thinking about it now is pretty scary.
It got under my skin as a concept, not knowing if your thoughts were your own thoughts. You were sort of downplaying a little bit the effect of it, and it's quite a profound mental prison that you come up with for these characters. I think you should be quite chuffed with it, really.
Right.
I can tell you feel bad for upsetting me.
Yeah, well, I do. I don't like it. I don't. You know, I'm not. I remember I was on a panel at a American convention a long time ago, and somebody said, "Oh, I love." He or she said, "I love upsetting people and disgusting people and making them feel awful." And I sort of said, "I don't. I'm not a horror writer who." And maybe it sounds, you know. Not the way it should be, but I don't set out to really upset and horrify. I set out to tell a good story. Like I said, I wanted to write a good horror romp. But in the course of doing that, you can't, you know, I guess you can't help but come up with ideas that are pretty disturbing. I hate the idea of somebody finishing my book and being disgusted or horrified, but also the book staying with them for certain reasons is a good thing. So I guess I'm trying to say sorry. Yeah, great.
I think stuff like this is just real proof of, you know, you wrote a book that you had a certain intent for, and loads of people will read it and just be like, that's a great action sci-fi horror novel. But like, there's people like me who bring something to it. Yeah. I think there's that, I don't know, telepathy across time and space of a book, right? You write a thing, I read it, and we have this momentary, you know, linkage, I suppose, but it's a unique relationship every time Link. In the reading, because I'm bringing a particular, this is quite an obvious thing what I'm saying here. I'm just saying it in convoluted terms, but every single interaction between a writer and a reader is its own thing. And that book becomes its own book in that instance of those two people being connected. So it's like you've written as many books as you have readers.
Yeah,
you know, I find
absolutely.
That a really sort of quite cheerful thought, really.
But yeah, everyone reads a book differently. You know, there's the old, you know, I don't reread books very often, but when I do, I read The Stand this year, last year, for the first time in about 25 years, probably for the fourth or fifth time. Probably read it quite differently from how I've read it before. But I'm fascinated by the link between writer and reader, and how, you know, I love hearing about bits of my books that people pick on as being the stuff that sticks with them, and others don't even mention it, you know. And the obvious extension of that is 5-star reviews and 1-star reviews, and I sort of like the fact that, you know, if I had 100 5-star reviews, it would be lovely. Never going to happen, but getting a few 1-stars, I think, yeah, fair enough. I've written something that's not touched some people in the way it touches other people, and that's part of the business and part of the craft, isn't it? Really, I also say if you've written a book that everyone, if you've written a book that everyone loves, maybe you haven't quite done your job right. That sounds
no. I always think this.
Maybe perverse, no. Coming from a writer.
No, but I always think this. I think human experience is varied and vast enough that if you are pleasing everybody, it's like you've almost written it by committee. You want to piss some people off, because otherwise your book isn't really human.
Yeah.
You know, I do think
That's a good, that you see, you put it much better than I could. Yeah, that's right, actually. That's as I see it. Yeah, yeah.
Well,
I mean, a lot of writers listening to this may not like that idea, but and also, you know, I got to say, I do write to myself. I write stories that I'd want to read. I write stories that excite me. And that's probably the other reason a lot of my stuff's become people being chased across extreme landscapes, because I do a lot of running across extreme landscapes. And, you know, the whole write about what you know thing does come into it in some of these books, for sure.
Well, you've done me an absolute service there, because you've brought me round right at the end to running.
Oh, there
because
you go.
I've left it this long so that we don't sabotage the entire conversation.
Well, you got another 2 hours, haven't we?
Yeah. I mentioned right at the top that we're both avid runners. Now, let me just be clear. You're a lot more avid than me, because I need to say this. I have friends from my immediate running circle who listen to this and who will mock me mercilessly if I pretend to be something I'm not. So let's just say I'm an enthusiast, you're an athlete. I'm still living down the fact that I spoke to Thomas Ulder Hervelt, and he was talking about mountaineering and going up massive bloody Mont Blanc and stuff on crampons and ropes, and talking about the terror of that. And I told him about the time that I nearly died in the Yorkshire Dales, and my friends have never let me live it down. So you're an athlete. I'm an enthusiast.
Well, I like the fact that when you do an Ironman, they call you athletes. I don't... You know, I'm a very slow Ironman athlete, but, you know, I get it done. But the nearly dying in the Yorkshire Dales, I nearly died on Snowdon when, oh God, we could talk for hours, couldn't we? Yeah, you know, it's your writing, your running friends shouldn't mock you, because it's easy to die in those sort of landscapes. You know, once you get off the road onto trails, especially if you're going up slopes and up hills, you know, you're on top of hills and it's cold. I did the Three Peaks Challenge about 12 or 13 years ago. It's the first really physical thing I did, and it's the thing that got me into the sort of stuff I do now, the slightly abnormal exercise sort of stuff I do. I literally nearly died on Snowdon. The weather was terrible. I got split up from my group, and I didn't understand how to look after yourself on a mountain. Yeah. And even though there were loads and loads and loads of people up there, the weather was terrible. I got I went off the trail and I thought, I'll climb down the mountainside here because I can see the lakes at the bottom. I'll just climb down. And halfway down, I suddenly, oh no, this is a bad idea. So I went back up, found a path, went down. And then I saw where I'd been climbing, which ended in a sheer drop of about 100 feet. And I was close.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I'm on your side, Neil. It's dangerous.
The trouble is that we are complete dicks because we just go off and do these things in a gung-ho fashion, me and my mates. And there's a thing in Yorkshire called the Three Peaks, which is just three big hills.
Yorkshire Three Peaks, yeah. There's a Monmouthshire Three Peaks where I live.
Is there? Right, okay. So we were running through them, but we did it because of course we did, in the middle of December.
Yeah, right.
And because we were running, we just did it in like shorts and T-shirts. Which is fine when you're running, but when you get tired and can't run anymore, you get very cold. And I remember thinking, going up Wernside, my friend's pulling away into the mist,
right.
And me literally thinking, I always thought disasters in this kind of world were kind of binary. You were fine or you were down a ravine with a broken leg. And I'm like, no, I could just slip into hypothermia and like be in real trouble.
Yeah.
And it's when do you pull that ripcord? When do you say like definitely. Enough's enough? You know, anyway, it worked out fine. And I've been mocked ever since for comparing it to real mountain danger. But I'm glad you endorse my worries.
Oh, I do, definitely. Yeah.
I mean, you mentioned Iron Man. I mean, how many of those have you done?
I've done six now.
Jesus.
So I did my first in 2012, which was Iron Man UK. So I've done extremes of Iron Man. I've done the branded stuff, which is all the big razzmatazz and the Iron Man brand. I've done three of those. I did Bolton and then Ironman Tempe. And then on my 50th birthday, I did Ironman Canada in Whistler, which was incredible.
Wow.
Actually, on my 50th birthday. So I'll never forget my 50th birthday.
Can we just explain for listeners who don't know, an Ironman, what are the distances again, Tim?
So it's a 2.4-mile swim and then 112-mile bike ride and then a marathon. And you get 17 hours to finish it.
Yeah. It's a serious thing.
It's a serious thing, yeah.
If you've done Ironman Bolton, you've pretty much run past my front door.
Ah, right. Okay. Are you in the city then?
No, I'm in a little village just down the road. It kind of goes.
Right.
It goes past, well, it doesn't anymore. It used to go past pretty much my front door. So yeah, I used to go and cheer. But you've done these Ironmans. What's the toughest run you've ever either accomplished or attempted?
Well, my favorite and the hardest one I've done is, I should have known from the name, it's called the Brutal. And it's the same distances. It's 2.4-mile swim and then 116-mile bike ride around Snowdonia, which is fairly hilly. And then for the run, you do three – it's a trail run. You do three laps of Lake Padan and then you go up and down Snowdon to finish. And that's the last 9 miles of your marathon up and down the mountain. And the first time I did it, there was a red weather warning and they actually closed the mountain and sent everyone down. So they gave us two more laps of the lake, which was – pretty soul-destroying in the dark with 40-mile-an-hour, 50-mile-an-hour gusts, rain, cold. So I went back last year to do it properly, and I did it. My defining moment, my best moment from last year. So last year was, I had some good moments. I won a World Fantasy Award. That was nice. other stuff happened. But my best moment from last year was standing on top of Snowdon at the Trig Point, 1 o'clock in the morning, on my own, not another soul around me. The weather was so good. All I had on was my tri suit and a survival rucksack. Looking up at the stars because it was a clear sky and seeing the Milky Way. And it was, I did have a little moment there, I must say, because I knew then that I'd finished. All I had to do was run down the mountain at 2 in the morning, which wasn't as easy as it sounds. But the Brutal is the hardest I've done. So I'm doing it again this year, of course, because it's the last year that they're doing it, which is really sad because it's a wonderful event. I like I've done the big events with thousands of people cheering you through the streets. That's amazing. You do feel like an athlete then. But I love the Brutal where you can be on your own at the top of the mountain. You know, there's safety people scattered around, but I love me against the race, not me against all the other athletes around me, because I'm not fast. I'm never going to win anything. I do it for the challenge and for the satisfaction of finishing it. Like, you do long runs, and I'm sure you've heard the term, and you sometimes don't want to go out on a run, but you never regret having done it.
No,
and it's the same as, you know, these races I do.
I'm fighting the urge to talk about running, and so I'm not going to do that. I'm going to ask you another question.
No, go on. Can I ask you a question?
Of course, yeah.
You trail run, don't you? Is that generally?
I'm just an amateur. I just plod about. I tend to. I'm better at sort of speed stuff, so I'm better at like a fast 10K on the road or a fast half marathon.
Oh, okay.
But I live in like prime trail running country, so I get out and about and do. In lockdown, me and my friends did this. It kept us sane. Because I ran every single day of 2020. I started doing a streak, and then lockdown happened.
Oh, wow.
So I just kept
going.
So I was just broken by it. I finished on New Year's Eve with a marathon that I did myself just around the area.
Oh, fantastic.
But me and my friends did this thing where we, in fact, Tim, if ever you're in the north, come on, meet my club, because you'd be like, we have a few celebrity kind of people. You'd be very welcome.
Okay.
But we did a thing in the summer where 2 weeks apart, we did three trail runs. One was like 45 miles.
Oh, wow.
One was like we did a 50 mile one that was just how we didn't kill each other. I don't know. It was a lot of walking up hills and being grumpy, you know. And like, there was one point during that day where we lost the trail and we rolled under a barbed wire fence. And I was like, this is no longer running. This is just being lost.
It's survival. Yeah.
But I got so fit off doing that low impact, you know, steady stuff compared to like hammering down the road like I normally do. It was it was way better. But I do gravitate more towards like road marathons and road running. I haven't done many marathons, and I really fall apart on them.
Right.
I really fall apart. I'm just not fit enough. I can do a half, but a marathon kills me.
Yeah. Honestly, calling me an athlete and you've done 50 milers.
No, I staggered around one 50 mile route, Tim. It wasn't in any way competitive. It was just sort of eight blokes falling out in a field. But I do it. I love the road stuff because I get to switch off and I get to just like put a podcast on and run and not think. So what I want to ask you is, how does your running sit alongside your writing? Is it a source of sort of contemplation and inspiration, or is it an escape from all of that?
Oh, it's 99% an escape. I mean, so I do road running. I love trail running. Mm. It's my thing. I live in Monmouthshire. So as I said, there's a Monmouthshire Three Peaks and the three mountains surrounding my local town of Aberdeenbeny. And my favorite thing is just get up into a mountain. And I don't do the distances you do very often. You know, I'll do 7 or 8, 9, 10 miles on a Saturday or Sunday around the local hills. And it's total switch off. And I don't listen to music or podcasts. I just go and listen, you know, listen to nature. Bike training I usually do with a friend, and that's more social. It's probably why I'm not very fast. Mm. You know, I don't go out and do a fast bike ride. I go out and do a slow 50 miler with coffee and cake halfway through, but it's a social thing, but it's still getting the miles in. But running in the hills for me is almost meditation. You know, I meditate occasionally anyway, but my best meditation is just going out. And I like trail running because it makes you mindful and present, because you have to pay attention to every step you take.
Yeah.
So you're always there, you know, in the moment, because you take a step wrong and you twist an ankle. Just occasionally when I'm running, it feeds into the writing. A plot point will come through or something like that, but not very often. What it does do is it's affected, like I said in the past, earlier in the interview, it sort of feeds into the writing I do sometimes, writing about what you know. So a lot of the time, like in Eden, my novel, my characters were adventure runners. So some people who read the book said, God, he talks about running a lot. And it's probably true. And then the novel I mentioned earlier called The Hunt, I wrote about 8 or 10 years ago now. That was literally right about what you know. So The Hunt is one of the two novels I've written that aren't fantastical. It's a straight thriller, and it's about a guy. It's essentially an Iron Man. It's about me, really. I'm the guy. His family's kidnapped, and he's the target of a paid hunt for rich bastards, you know. So they tell him, if you escape, your family die. If you're caught and killed, we release your family. So he's got this dilemma. So there's literally running, biking, and swimming in it through the Welsh mountains while he's being hunted down. So it does. My sort of exercise habits do feed into my writing, but not. I wouldn't say I go out for a run to think through a plot point. That doesn't work.
Right. Okay.
Clears the cobwebs.
Yeah.
I did write a book.
You did, and that was my next question. I was going to say you have a book out running. If you want to give that a short push, I have listeners who would either enjoy it or would perhaps use it as a springboard into this. But tell us briefly about your running book.
When I started doing all this exercise, I kept a website called Run, Walk, Crawl, and I do race reports, and I'd even do stuff like review new kit and stuff like that. And it sort of drifted away, but I kept all the race reports. And then I think somebody said to me, because I'm 54 now, and so as I got to the end of as I turned 50, someone said, well, you should write a book, because when you were 40, you were fat and unfit, and I was. I said, yeah, that'd be a good laugh. And I started thinking about it. And during lockdown, I finished it and I had such good fun. And it's very lighthearted. It's not, I stress that I'm not a coach. You know, it's important to stress that I'm not a coach. But I picked up a few things on the way and I offered tips. It's really satisfying. So I do know it's inspired quite a few people to go off and do a Three Peaks challenge or to enter a half marathon or just to start running. And it's called Run, Walk, Crawl, and it's available on Amazon. It's self-published. It's my the only book I've ever self-published. I put some novellas up on Kindle, and I love the book. And it's in a way, I wrote it as a way for me to remember my sort of exercise adventure through my 40s. Mm. And it came out. It turned out into this book, which is quite fun. I got some really great people to endorse it. Chrissy Wellington, she's the four-time Ironman world champion. She's brilliant. Sean Conway, you know, the guy that just did 105 Ironmans in 105 days. He read it and endorsed it for me before.
Oh, there you go.
He does loads of crazy stuff. Yeah. So it's fun. It's a fun book.
Well, there you are, listeners. If you want to blend horror adjacency, I suppose, it's a book about running written by a horror writer.
Get on it.
It's basically my perfect book in a way, and if you think about it.
Well, it's got a whole chapter on cake. So... that's why I do this stuff.
Well, to finish up, could you recommend someone else's book that you think my listeners would enjoy?
Yeah. So I'm going to recommend a book that isn't out yet.
Okay.
I don't know if anyone's ever done that. So
yeah, they have. That's fine.
Have they? Oh, God, I thought I was being original there, Neil. Okay. So I'm great friends with Rio Ewers, a Canadian writer. Brilliant, brilliant writer, thriller writer, horror writer. Rio's got a new book out soon. Very soon, called The Bang Bang Sisters. It's a thriller featuring a band called The Bang Bang Sisters, three sisters, Brea, Jessie, and Flo. But they're not just sisters. They're not just musicians. They're also contract killers. So this band travels around taking contracts to kill, and they kill bad people. They kill gangsters who've got away with shit and, you know, murderers who've through a loophole in the system have got away with terrible things, and they're drawn back, and I've been lucky enough to read the book. They're drawn back to a town where something happened previously, and they're sort of schemed and pitted against each other. And the sort of tag of the book is three sisters, one day only one can survive. Rio is such a underappreciated writer, and I've always thought that he's one of my favorite writers, and I'd say that if he wasn't a good mate as well. Anyone, lots of people listening would have read Rio's books. He's written horror and dark thrillers, horror thrillers, and I really think this is the one that's going to rocket him into the stratosphere, because he deserves it, and this book deserves it. It's a really brilliant thriller. So The Bang Bang Sisters, it's out. I'm thinking sort of maybe June, May or June. It's out pretty soon.
I've just looked. It's July 16th.
Ah, there we go. Perfect. And thanks, Neil. Yeah,
that
yeah.
sounds great. That great sounds novel. Great. Yeah, I love those kind of high concept title thrillers.
And it is high concept. That's the great thing about it, you know. Yeah, and it's such a good title. It combines, you know, his love of rock. So Rio's in a band. He's a guitarist. He's a singer. It combines his love of music and thrillers, and it does it really well.
Well, thank you. That's a good one. It's a new recommendation, so it's always useful. That goes in the show notes with all the other books mentioned. So cheers for that. My last question, Tim, and you're the first person to answer this twist on the theme. I've been closing with the previous, 181, 182 episodes with, you know, what truly scares you. It's getting a bit rote now. I'm getting a lot of the same answers. So to keep things more current and useful for the foreseeable, I'll be asking, when was the last time something really scared you? Films, books, real life, whatever. What was the last thing that got right under your skin?
Okay. I've got two things. The first I'll just throw in there because we talked about it. So the morning of the brutal Iron Man, you get up at 3 a.m. and start feeding yourself for the day ahead. Those few hours before the race is a genuine moment of severe butterflies because you know what's coming.
Mm.
And it's not a, I guess you could say it scared me, but unsettled me. I knew what was coming, but I put myself in for it. So, you know, you just suck up, nut up or shut up. But a movie that scared me recently, I watched at Christmas called Barbarian.
Yeah.
I'm sure you've seen it and lots of people have seen it. The first half of that film, I think it got a bit silly towards the end, but the scene where the character goes beneath the house into the sort of tunnels and the cellars beneath the house.
Mm-hmm.
So brilliantly done, atmospheric and scary without you really seeing anything.
Yeah.
And there's hints down there, there's shadows moving, there's hints. And then she sees like a cage and something. And it's quite a long scene where she first explores down there. And then, you know, stuff happens. But you gradually build in this disturbing picture of something being very, very wrong. And it's quite a slow build, and generally they're the best ones. And that, I remember, I'm pretty sure I paused it for a while just before carrying on because I thought this is going to be grim.
I think it was my favourite horror film of last year.
Right, yeah. I loved it until I think it went a bit silly and over the top at the end, maybe.
Mm, yeah, it does.
But
it does.
Probably the first two-thirds were brilliant. Really, really well done.
There's a moment in that I'm going to be, because it's a film that really hinges on not knowing its secrets. I don't want to spoil it for people, but do everyone watch Barbarian? Yeah. It's on Disney or Hulu to stream, so really worth watching. What I would say, there's one scene in it, and you'll know what I mean by this, Tim, where, right, how to phrase this. There's a scene where the thing you're supposed to be scared of, it's the thing you're supposed to be terrified of, and that the characters are terrified of, there's a scene where the scary thing is too scared to approach a certain room. Do you know what I mean?
That's it. Yeah.
It left me with the deepest sense of sorrow. I just felt it like, whereas afterwards I was saying to on Twitter saying like, why is no one talking about how sad this film is? You know, about how tragic the monster is. So I think it's a brilliant film, and that those early scenes when something's not quite right with this setup with these two people in this house, and then that open basement door, like nothing good is going to happen in that basement. I know exactly what you mean, that sense of foreboding and dread. Yeah, brilliant film.
And the way it flips expectations, you think you know where it's going, but you really, really don't.
No.
Clever. Loved it in a grim way.
Well, great first answer to that new question.
Cool. Good.
Seems fitting to ask that question for the first time. Somebody whose book really scared me. Listeners, don't let my induced panic put you off, as if you would. I mean, that's basically a 5-star review amongst us. Among the Living is out now. It's everything Tim and I have talked about. It's fast, it's propulsive, it's genuinely nightmarish. I would definitely check it out. But for now, Tim Levin, thanks for talking scared.
Cheers, Neil. Thank you very much. It's been a pleasure.
Sorry about the running chat. I kind of forgot that this was a show for other people for a moment and not just my chance to chat with another nerd who loves horror books and running up hills. So if you've stuck with us, Thank you very much. And you should check out Tim's intro to running book, Run, Walk, Crawl. It's just a charming little inspiration. It really is. And just to dispense with this now, if you do enjoy getting out and about in your trainers, I've started a Talking Scared Strava group. Strava, for those who don't know, is a running app sort of come social media platform where we can share our runs, our achievements, ideally our spooky photos of things we see out on the trails. I have many because I live in a haunted landscape. Just go to the Strava app and search for Talking Scared and request access. It can be our way of sharing the pain together. This is not an ad. I have no affiliation with Strava. It's just the app that I use to map my exercise. And I'd love to see what you guys get up to and where you go and the sights you see. And let's, you know, as I say on that group, let's train to avoid the man with the axe together. But back to Tim and this episode. I think he was genuinely upset that his book had upset me. And I wanted him to know that, one, I'm certifiable. Everything has the potential to disturb me because I'm weak. And two, that's not a bad thing from a talent and storytelling perspective. You know, the power to upset is power. And I've already explained why this book tweaked my nerves, the whole metacognition thing. If other people have that, feel free to get in touch. We can fret together. But don't let that put you off, because this isn't a disturbing book for most people. It's what Tim and I said it is. It's a roller coaster, a genuinely fun, action-packed horror adventure, but with enough character and genuine thought to elevate things beyond the norm. I really, really liked it, as upsetting as it was. And I also loved his novel Eden. I haven't read The Last Storm, but I've heard good things about that too. So I'd check out all three, because Tim writes proper, enjoyable, unflinching, unpretentious horror stories. Very much like James Herbert, actually, though without the contractually obligated sticky sex scenes. It's actually cool that Tim makes his central pairing in this book a platonic friendship. It adds an interesting dimension, interesting dynamic. And this is from me, who's always banging on about there not being enough sex in horror. But I should have asked him about James Herbert. When Tim said he'd met him, I meant to come back to that and ask, but I got sidetracked. And I'm gutted, because Herbert is such a pivotal figure in 80s and 90s horror, especially the British scene. Just like Tim, I read The Rat when I was way too young, with its baby-eating scene. My teacher actually wrote to my parents about it after he confiscated it, the prick. But I wish I'd asked Tim what Herbert was like, because I always imagine him to have been a slightly odd man. Don't know why. If any of you have ever met him, let me know. That's as good a reason as any to get in touch, right? Email me at talkingscaredpod@gmail.com or find me on all the socials at talkscaredpod. I'm still looking to grow the Instagram network, so come say hi there especially. And if you can, please subscribe and review on Apple or Spotify or wherever you get this podcast. It makes a big difference to shows like mine. And again, the Patreon is there for those who want all that sweet, extra bloody nectar. Patreon.com/talkingscaredpod. Before I go, one correction. I talked about the Atomic Brotherhood, crowbarred into the conversation, really, as I sometimes cringingly do. I did get details a bit wrong. That whole thing about stories to save us from nuclear waste, it isn't the Atomic Brotherhood, it's the Atomic Priesthood. And that wasn't the name of the think tank entrusted with coming up with the ideas. The think tank was called the Human Interference Task Force, and the Atomic Priesthood was the name they give to that idea, this idea of imprinting a mythology into the culture to last into the future and warn us about nuclear waste. They actually wanted to create a tradition of storytelling that was modelled on the Catholic Church, who, let's face it, have done quite well embedding warnings into human culture. Now, I know none of you care about that correction, but if I'm going to force my own only slightly relevant knowledge into someone else's interview, then I should at least get it right. So Google the Human Interference Task Force, because it is fascinating. As is next week's guest. Gwendolyn Keist is back on the show for her second appearance, talking about her ever-so-liminal novel of alternative haunting called The Haunting of Velkwood. It's such a cheerful, fun conversation, despite the subject matter. You'll love it. It'll energise your commute, no doubt. But until then, lace up your shoes, stretch out your muscles properly, and don't quit until you reach whatever finish line you're heading for. Read good books, and remember, it's good to be scared.